Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
You are about to listen to Rich Tang's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with my special guest, the curmudgeonly idiot, Stuart Lee. This is the final one in the series. We're hoping to make some more in June and July. You can help us in lots of different ways. Why don't you come and see me on tour? That would be a fantastic help. By the time you listen to this, I should have a young baby. I need to start making some money for myself. And so that would be a great way to help me. Go to richherring.com/lotds/tour. And you can see all of the tour dates. See if I'm coming near to you. I'm going to be coming up Colchester and Aylesbury, Exeter, Cheddar, Nottingham, Wolverhampton, Salford, Chorley, Brighton. The list goes on. Go and check it out yourself. Go to gofosterstripe.com/badges, make a one-off or monthly donation, which will help us make more stuff. You can go to eBay, look for me, Herring1967. You can buy stuff there from my past, which will hopefully fund my future and help us to make new stuff. If you don't want to pay for any of this, that is fine. It is free. That's why it's free. Sorry you have to listen to this message at the beginning. I know it annoys you, and that's the only reason I do it. Why not just tell your friends about this podcast, get them to listen to them all, and hopefully they'll pay a small amount of money in order to help us keep going, because you are too mean. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Well, this is a very, very special podcast because Richard Herring is in it. Please welcome him, Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Love to see you. Thanks for coming out. You're much better than last week's audience. So, welcome to a very special, it's the final Rich Tang's Leicester Square Theatre podcast of this series, or as some of the cool kids have started calling it, Rahalastapa.
That's what they're calling it. There's a lot very excited. You're excited about Stuart Lee coming on? Is everyone? Ooh, you excited? Who? Did you not realise who was here? What is your favourite thing that was ever in This Morning with Richard Not Judy?
I think it was far, 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 far.
It was far, 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 barking. We'll probably talk about that, yes. I don't know if anyone did. I don't know how the BBC didn't notice that, but I did. I did pretty much swear every single week. But to be honest, we just pretty much just swore. Anyway, the one I saw just had someone saying cock for about 5 minutes. Admittedly, it was talking about cocks fighting, but it became very clear that that was not what. Andy McCaich, who was kindly given us a clapperboard for the show. Thank you for that, Andy. What was your favourite thing in This Morning with Shot Judy?
I like a bird's eye, which is also German for egg.
That was a good bit. I like a bird's eye, which is German for egg. We'll see if we can get Stu. I'm hoping Stu, like when I got Harry Shearer on, I managed to get him to do some of the voices. I'm hoping I can get Stu to do. He's very cool these days, so it'll be hard to get him. See if he can do it. For me, Pliny is the best thing by far. Seriously. I would happily just watch him do that for the rest of his career. Not because it's good, just it would be satisfying. Did you say you are? I mean, we're looking at the YouGov website over the last few weeks, where they have the archetypal Rich Herring fan or whatever fan. Now, it does. The picture on that website does not look like you, but it should look like you, sir. So, what's your name?
Mark.
And did you have a favourite character or moment from This Morning, Rich? Not Judy.
Consider the Lily.
That was a good bit as well. You've got very good taste, all of you. My favourite, the favourite bit of Pliny is the one I just, the St George one I just watched the other day, because of the, as we're recording this, we've had the controversy over the lady tweeting a picture of some flags, some St George flags, and having to resign for putting a picture on Twitter without comment, which seems weird. But someone put up the St George Histor's eye, and my favourite bit is when Histor goes, "As the crow flies," and Pliny goes, "As the egg flies." And it's like Pliny was really trying to think of a pun. Flies. Can't think of one of this. It's the best thing that Stuart Lee has ever done. So will you please welcome my guest this week. He is probably best known from the B Skype Up Your News. And for being Pliny in This Morning Rich Not Judy, we welcome Stuart Lee, ladies and gentlemen. Come on in. He's got three beers. Three beers. And one of them isn't for me. How are you doing, Stu?
All right.
A bit tired?
Yeah.
It's hard life, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
difficult. You'll see.
I will. Stuart has two children. I have a child on the way. I was thinking, there's two things we could do with our children. A, we could do a Lee and Herring the Next Generation, where one of your children and one of my children team up. We could just give them the same material. Yeah. No one will remember. Or, you know, you've got one of each, so whatever I have, they could get married, couldn't they? I could marry one of your...
My kids think I'm terrible at good comedy. And they... Because my son stood at the side of the stage and... watched me once and said, he said, "It's awful, he's just talking, no one's laughing." But they think my wife's funny because she used to dress up as things, so they can see that that's supposed to be. Well, basically, they have the sensibilities of children, they don't understand what it is I'm trying to do, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't think you should really. Well, wait for 10 or 15 years and then show they might enjoy it then. So, you don't want to. Do I have an arranged marriage between my as yet unborn child and whichever child?
No, could be you know.
No, okay, we'll wait and see. But imagine if our children had a child together. Imagine what that would be like. No? Okay. I'm going to call my child either Leanne or Leon. So... give him a good start in life. Anyway, we will that might not make it into the final bit, so that's why you should come and see it live. So the This Morning Rich Not Judy began in 1994.
Yeah,
do you remember that?
Well, I remember that you did a... You were doing a show in Edinburgh at lunchtime called that.
Yeah.
And then at the last minute, I came in to help fill it up because there wasn't any script or plan. Yeah. But I didn't... It wasn't my thing.
No.
You know, and then... And then it sort of snowballed a bit. And it was quite an interesting way of sort of satirising the economics of Edinburgh, which is that it was... You were less likely to lose as much money if you just gave tickets away to something in the street than you were if you put them through the normal system, which is... I don't really understand why 20 years later you're still with the same management company, given that... You saw through it in the mid-90s, and yet you still seem to make a big song and dance about how you're delighted to lose all this money, and yet as a child you essentially saw through, and you expect people to be sympathetic in some way to something that you saw through as a child. But anyway, that was sort of the idea. It was making a kind of parody of an Edinburgh show whereby we didn't have anything. We tried to give the tickets away to people that would pay for them in the street. And then we sort of did like chat and mad made up guests. And actually, the looseness of it, because it had no weight of expectation around it, I think actually created a show for the telly that had the same looseness and freedom of expectation.
I suppose so. I mean, I don't think that year, 1994, we weren't really even thinking of putting forward anything. I think like Robin Ince came and did some stuff, and Tom Binns did little bits and pieces in it.
It was in an attic, and actually, the person on before us or after us was this. Sort of a brilliant, overexcited Irishman doing something based on a kind of flimsy piece of kitsch about the Carpenters, which was Graham Norton, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, and it was.
Yeah, thought, God, he's never going to get anywhere.
It really was. But I'd actually forgotten the very start of this idea for a TV show. Because I took this idea and then I thought I had a meeting with Nick. What's the guy from Anne and Nick? Was he Nick? Was he Nick? Nick Owen. I was going to say Nick Ross, but it's Nick Owen.
Meeting with Nick Owen.
I'd met Nick Owen at the Ritz. I went.
You were living a very different life. To
I went because we were trying to court Nick Owen, and so
he was.
The original idea for the show was that I would do it in the morning with Nick Owen. It's going to be called This Morning with Richard and Nick.
First I've heard about it.
I met Nick Owen.
You see what he was doing. I was just like doing the stand-up circuit, doing like 30 quid gigs in pubs. Richard Herring was at the Ritz with Nick Owen, trying to get his own thing going with him and Nick Owen, not with me in it.
This could be a very different...
And then he had to come crawling back because Nick Owen...
I've totally forgotten this. I've just this minute remembered it.
No memory.
And I met up with him because I'd seen him. He'd been on Fantasy Football and he'd been surprisingly sort of funny and up for a laugh.
I can't even remember who. I remember his name. Yeah. Who was he?
It was like he was a avuncular TV.
Adrian Child sort of character.
Yeah, yeah. Without the personality. But he was quite going to take the piss out. So it was nearly going to be sort of a semi-serious. Not semi-serious, but a piss take, you involving the real people from it, then he wouldn't do it. So I got you in it instead. But then we did it in Edinburgh. It was in 1994, I gave away a car as a prize. So we gave away prizes. So we spent a lot of the money we made from it.
And when we say a car, this was 20 years ago, where not all people that own cars expect to have a top-of-the-range new car that they paid for, an HP. Most people 20 years ago were driving around in 30-year-old cars that didn't work, and that's what he gave.
Well, we bought a car for £300.
Yeah.
I mean, it was still quite a lot of money to spend, but we got some publicity out of it. And then the guy came down and said, do you want to gamble? He'd won like £10, and we said, do you want to gamble on that, not on the mystery star prize? And he gambled, and he won a £300 car that had to tax for about two more months.
Yeah.
And he was a student who won it, and he could drive. But he had a car already, and it was the exact same model and colour, I think, of car. I think he drove it home, and then I think he might have crashed it. Yeah. The memory is just coming back to me. But
he's all right. That same year, I remember, I was doing the Club Zarathustra show in the sort of barn venue at the Pleasance with Simon Munnery and Richard Thomas, and Simon Munnery had this idea that he would make a grand entrance onto the stage in a little three-wheel Robin Reliant. That would have been decorated with all sort of quasi-fascist regalia. And so we bought one, customised it. It's a funny idea, basically. You come on stage to sort of Wagner in a sort of, in a with fascist regalia on a three-wheeled Robin Reliant. And so him and Richard Thomas bought it, did it up. It took them about 2.5 days to drive it to Edinburgh, where they stayed awake with amphetamines, I think. And then they got there, and it was about 6 inches too wide to drive through. But yeah, I mean, that's another weird thing. It's funny, it's the sort of risk-taking. I mean, I listened to the first half of this over there, it was me that prompted Paul to say his anecdote about Secret Affair, which was actually much funnier when he told it to me a few weeks ago. But didn't really have. But part of why you were able to develop a show like this that ended up being this sort of mad show on the telly was because the economics were so, you know, it was so much freer then, and you could sort of afford to take chances on things. And I don't know. You couldn't have, you know, well, I mean, you'd do it anyway because you seem to have a masochistic delight in unnecessarily losing thousands of pounds. But no one in their right mind now would develop a show with such broad parameters and no obvious aims at Edinburgh as we did 20 years ago when the losses were absorbable and when you could raffle a car off that cost you 300 quid. I mean, it feels like it's really weird to get to your late 40s and your descriptions of your own adolescence or your 20s, it sounds like you're talking about the 50s. It seems like a long time ago.
It was very different in terms of like the number of acts. So yeah. Like it really, well, I was talking to like Sue Perkins and just thinking like in the 90s basically there was 20 or 30 people and you kind of thought, oh, you'll all get your turn eventually.
Well, there were about 60 or 70 comedy shows then. There's like 600 now.
Yeah.
And also people didn't get their turn. I mean, you can think of all the brilliant people that did shows that are much better than you, and some of them better than me as well. And yet loads of them didn't go on to, you know, I mean, didn't go on to. There's loads of brilliant people that we would all have seen in that period that didn't go on to do anything, you know. And I don't think there was a meritocracy at work, but there isn't now, and there wasn't.
I think it's not a meritocracy. It was just there was at least a chance. Whereas now, I think there's 600 shows. However, and there's lots, and people are better, and people are prepared. You know, we generally turned 1997. We generally turned up on the first day without anything, and we went to a flat with Richard Thomas and bust some ideas around with him, and then we said, "Well,
yeah,
do
but
this,
we had like, but we both." Individually and together, we had a back catalogue of stuff that you could have cobbled together, you know. And I mean, whenever you talk about that period, it is worth remembering about all the brilliant people that slipped through the cracks, like Johnny Immaterial, like Kevin McAleer, like I mean, do you remember that Scottish double act? One of the guys is a cartoonist for Private Eye now, Packer, Dallas and Packer. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was
really good. I mean, there's loads of stuff and. And they're, admittedly, when you talk about last night's show here of new materials, of the new acts, there's a professionalism about it, there's a focus about it, there's a work ethic about it that was absent 20, 30 years ago. But I miss the people where you would look at their act, like the Iceman, whose act was he melted ice. He didn't have a career plan, you know. And you think, I miss those things.
Yeah,
know?
But there still are. I mean, I actually think that what's going on now, you keep harking back to the 1980s as being an amazing time for comedy, and you can say that, but then the 1980s didn't have you in it, for a start. So you know, I think now is much, but you know, I think the broad range of stuff you get now is much more exciting, and there are loads of people doing those kind of things. Someone like the Iceman was great,
yeah,
that he would turn up and do his insane thing, but that was never going to be much more than that. Someone like Mr. Methane is still going, and he's got that kind of act that is just a ridiculous act. Yeah. So if you have the staying power to keep doing it, you could keep doing it. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of...
I suppose...
There's a lot of too professional, slick people.
When you compare Mr. Methane to the Iceman, I suppose, ultimately, farts are funnier than ice.
They are. But maybe they should have got together and... done something where he farted on ice
and you lit it, and it melted.
Make some kind of fire and ice and gas.
Well, then it starts to become profound.
They do. Yeah. That's what they need. But you know, I think there's a lot of very exciting comedians now. But I think it would be.
I know
very
you say. I read on your blogs that you say that.
Yeah.
But I think that's because you try to keep in with them.
It isn't.
It is. It is. You try to keep
in care.
With them.
I'm aware.
No, no,
I'm not in with anyone.
This young person on the.
I'm not even in with
they
the people.
They weren't, right?
Yeah.
But you try to keep in with them.
I'm not even in with the people I worked with 20 years ago.
No, but
so
I
that's,
mean, you
that's,
try to keep in with
them. I've noticed you all on TV, and I've noticed I'm not in any of those TV shows. So I know that I'm not in
I
with
think
anyone.
You like to be seen as some sort of gatekeeper,
I don't.
Like patronising the young people.
I know. I'm yielding. I'm lying down, allowing them to run over me. I have no. I'm defeated. Let's face it. But so we did. So we took, I mean, I think like the influences for this morning for me, because I think this was it was something. I remember you were more cautious and not sure about.
Well,
doing.
I'd had enough, you know, yeah. of television, and the first series of Fist of Fun. I liked the aesthetic of it, and I liked the amount of preparation and planning we did for it. The second one, I didn't like the look of it, and I was panicked about how we were rushed into it, and I didn't. Really want to do anything again, and this was your thing, and I piggybacked into it. But I think actually, because it was a thing that was thrown together, and you had to write loads every week, it was actually very good for me to have to think like that, because I like to meticulously plan things, and I think that it was a great thing to have to work on the hoof, and also the fact that it was filmed live made all the difference, because. Something that was new that you'd only that you've been working on that week as a dialogue still had that flavour of
yeah.
And weirdly about you know when you look at the dialogues that are floating around on YouTube when we're doing the double act stuff together, some of it works, some of it doesn't, but the stuff that works really well is really great because it was really happening in real time and it was still sort of being assembled at the point where it was filmed. And one of the problems you have with comedy for telly is it necessarily has the dead hand of rehearsal on it, which can help it but can also take the edge off it. And in the second series of Fist of Fun, there was material that wasn't properly written, which had also been rehearsed to death. And but in this you sort of had the thing where it was still like
yeah.
you know coming together in
well,
and
we're making
eyes.
Stuff up as we go yeah, along. Yeah. And I think it was very exciting and vital that it is live. But yeah, we are. You can see us making up ideas and making each other laugh yeah. on the actual air. And yeah, when it does, also when it doesn't work, it's still great because I think we didn't feel that at the time.
No.
But when it doesn't work, it's actually great. When there's a bit where you're, I remember it happening where one of the early interviews, you were confused about what was going on, but they were talking to me about what was going on, and they had were talking, so they weren't talking to you. But then you're going, can someone tell me what you were... And you go, what's going on? And how long have we got for this bit? And it's kind of funny, because that shouldn't happen on TV.
No. Well, but actually, most of it was things that shouldn't happen on TV. And actually, loads of things that we tried really hard to do, lots of things that we weren't allowed to do on television. I remember I had a real bee in my bonnet about how... Because I was sort of we were sort of aware that it was going out early on Sunday morning, and in the late 90s there was a drug called ecstasy that lots of people took, and there was a whole culture of people going out and dancing on this drug, and we were sort of aware that there was a kind of come down culture, people had been out all night watching the program, or just people had been out on like Saturday night drinking, and I sort of liked the idea that it would be jarring and upsetting to them to wake up and watch this program, and I remember the. Wanted things that would make them feel ill that they were watching, and one of the things we tried to do was to put the theme music for things that fall over or when insects attack much much louder than anything else, and it was from a piece by the avant-garde composer Harrison Birtwistle, and I wanted it to go in like really really loud, and but it turned out there was all these rules, BBC rules about volume, you couldn't put it in, you can't suddenly have volume shifts, a limiter will kick in. And then we looked into this and we worked out the way Brian Eno got around this on producing a Talking Heads album was that instead he wanted to increase the volume but he wasn't allowed to, so he increased certain densities of certain frequencies so that it felt like it was getting louder even though it didn't actually go over. Anyway, we did that we did a thing of treating certain frequencies so they were more penetrating on the intro music to when things fall over and when it, which lasts, it's about a 5 second bit, but it was, there were lots of things that we managed to do that we weren't really supposed to do, including just jarring sonic pain for people in the mornings. So there were all sorts of things like that happening.
Well, I think it was because I kind of really wanted this time slot and you were kind of dubious about it, but I liked it because it was, you know, I think the Sunday show had done the slot before us, but I kind of thought, it's live. I think the thing that was great for us is we'd done two series of Fist Fun, which were not only rehearsed, but when we recorded them, we had to do everything 15 times.
Yeah.
And so what was really appealing about this morning was we only did it once. If it went wrong, it went wrong, but we only got to do it once. So that meant it was a 45-minute record, and then it was over, and then we went and drank vodka and Red Bull all afternoon. Amazing times. It was an amazing time for comedy. But I was very influenced in it, which I think you'll spot, by the Banana Splits, which most people will be too young to remember, but that was what I wanted. And it really, the Banana Splits had the same thing, which was there was a real kind of drug influence on there. I think the people were probably on drugs in the Banana Splits, which we weren't, and Tiz was, which again, I was watching a bit, which goes a little bit too far in the second episode where we've got the King, and we asked for the King who's got the least money on them. And then it's a little tiny kid, like he's called about 10 years old, but he's really brilliant. His edict is that Jim Davidson should be shut up in a prison.
Wow, he was ahead of his time.
Well, I'm just taking my cue from Tizzles. I'm just really shouting in this kid's face in a way you kind of go, oh, that's actually...
Well, actually, that's interesting you bring that up, because I grew up in the Midlands, and in the early 70s, there was this strange thing that happened. Chris Tarrant, bizarrely, who now seems like a pillar of the establishment, and various people like John Gorman, who are from 60s avant-garde theatre and are like weird kind of proto-alternative comedy groups. David Rappaport, who was an early acolyte of Ken Campbell, who's one of the sort of avatars of weird pre-alternative comedy. And Lenny Henry, who was like doing alternative comedy before it had a name, and they all had this strange slot on ATV, Midlands Independent Television, on Saturday mornings, where they sort of did this bizarre anarchic programme, which we remember as being proto-punk and sort of psychedelic hippie kind of programme, but actually it's full of the usual racist and sexist early 70s if you go back and look at it, but your memory of it is being this sort of unlicensed period, and there was a very anodyne BBC copy of it, Swap Shop, with Noel Edmonds, which is sort of the same thing but with every single piece of imagination or genius taken out of it. Where you lived as a child, you got that, didn't you?
I got it in Loughborough. In Loughborough, and then, but then I moved from Loughborough when I was 8 to Cheddar, and I got to Cheddar, and the man installing the TV, my sister said, "Do you have Shang-A-Lang in this..." which was the Bay City Rollers. My sister was obsessed with the Bay City Rollers. And then he went, yes, and she went, yes. And then I said, "Do you have Tiz Was?" And he said, "No." And I cried. I was 28 years old.
And actually... I think a lot of things that you do as an adult, you don't really realise, but you're trying to... you're trying to recreate things that were profoundly... It made an impression on you as a child. And actually, I think... Looking at it now with 20 years hindsight, there was a sort of Tiz Was thing going on. I'm thinking, well, you know, how do they get away with that on a Saturday morning, and how can we get away with the same kind of thing on a Sunday morning? And partly why we got away with it, to be fair, was because no one was remotely interested in it, and so no one even watched it to check what was going out. And when it stopped, no one noticed. And when it was going out, and in fact, one week. Two things that happened, give you an indication of the extent to which no one was interested in it. One week, about 5 minutes before we were supposed to do the live transmission, Charlie Hanson, the producer, who also wasn't that interested in it, to be honest, he just not really interested in anything he does. He was very good, but he don't care. But he does Derek. I mean, Jesus Christ, he obviously like doesn't give a fuck, does he? He's very good at, you know, realising the vision of the artist, but he's not. But he told us there was a kind of panic at about 12:10 before it started 12, and there wasn't no one had turned the transmission thing on, had they?
Right.
There was some thing that was supposed to broadcast it from the studio, and it had been written down as like a VT, you're being played in, and they had to like put it onto some other thing to get it to work. Then another week, it used to go out live on the Sunday. And I remember I used to do the edit with an editor guy on like the Thursday, and then he used to go out live 45, 50 minutes on Sunday morning. Then there was an edit for the Friday night, and it would go out at 6:15 on the Friday, 6:30 on the Friday, a half-hour edit. And I used to do the edit on Thursday afternoon. And I remember one Thursday morning, we were in rehearsal for the next week's show, and the Evening Standard came in. This is in the old days when there was newspapers, before you all just looked at things on online. The newspaper came in, and I went, oh, fuck, look. And they'd moved it to the Thursday night, but no one had told us. No one had told us. So no one had made the half-hour edit. So the programme was supposed to go out, didn't exist, and no one had thought it was worth telling us that it was going out. They'd moved it because there was tennis on or live coverage of a lawnmower or something. So they moved it. And then we had to do the edit in about 2 hours that afternoon. So that's an indication of the extent to which no one was interested. And in the last few weeks when it was supposed to be being cut, we did, to be fair, we did have our people who supported us, like Paul...
Jackson
and a couple of other people. And I remember they were desperately trying to get Jane Root, who was in charge of BBC at the time, to just come and see it just once so she would know what it was she was cancelling. And she kind of never came. But actually, those things, in retrospect, mean that because no one was interested in it and no one tried to stop what we were doing because they didn't even know it was on... You mustn't view this as like some struggle of outlaw artists against authority. It wasn't. Authority was not interested or aware. So it was not like a heroic struggle. It was just something that happened. Well, like someone doing a fart in a lift. But there was no one in the lift. So it wasn't like... It was just nothing. And then 20 years later, you've got all this stuff that was somehow allowed to happen.
But it does look insane. But I remember John Plowman, who was the executive producer, saying one way, I can't remember what it was, but saying there was something we wanted to keep in. I mean, that we had a lot of power because we could keep it in. I suppose because it was live. Yeah. And he said, if you don't cut this, I think it'll be a problem for getting extra stuff. And we kept the thing in. There's a bit in one I saw where you're just at the end. You go... on Sky TV they show The Simpsons and Seinfeld at good times, at proper times. You're kind of complaining about when we're going out, and then basically say go and watch Sky instead. So it's just, and you kind of think, I can probably see why the BBC weren't that.
But you know what, they should have been sort of accountable on some level, because there was a kind of weird thing where, you know, you were supposed to be grateful, which we obviously were, but on the other hand, all the things in the 90s, all the things that comedians loved. All comedians loved Seinfeld, you know, and the BBC had that, and yet it was out at 11:45.
Yeah, they had The Simpsons. They put it out on a Saturday at 5 or something, and they didn't know what. And then Seinfeld and Larry Sanders were on in the middle of the night, and you go anywhere else in the world, and those things were both on at 6 o'clock every single night because everyone loved them.
So I suppose it was sort of, you know, we sort of thought arrogantly we were belonged in that world, and why were those people?
Well, I think we did. I think because of that, it's very anarchic, and it's very, you know, the ones I watched again, there's a real excitement to it because it's live, and there's a bit where Joanne wins the ironic review, which again sort of is very much like things that were later to come, of sort of fly on the wall documentary about an officer, well, a magazine of idiots of the kind of Shoreditch twats that would later get their own series in it for someone else writing it. But Joe Unwin basically for like 3 minutes just saying the word cock about cockfighting, but it very clearly becomes that she's talking about the men's cocks. And you kind of think, that wouldn't go out at 9 o'clock or 8:30 now. So it's sort of been strange. And and as someone mentioned, I would, or every week, swear during the songs when we are crowning the king. Yeah, every week I'd go, there's only one king, wanking, wanking, and then fa 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 king, fa king. Every week I would do
that.
You
must be very proud of it.
I am very proud of it. I'm still proud.
Do you think that partly why you're allowed to do that is because people would have been embarrassed?
Lots of it's insane. The first series ends with us singing hymns. Do you remember we've got the audience to sing a hymn?
I'll tell you what, then it's been very interesting coming here. I don't really remember anything about it. I don't remember much, to be honest.
You remember a lot about the editing process.
I know, but I don't remember much from about 1995 to 2001. I don't know why that is. But what's nice about it is when things pop up on YouTube, Like there was a thing this week where there was a Histor's Eye sketch about the England flag, and because there's been people talking about the England flag this week, it sort of popped up on the internet, and I watched it, and I have no memory of doing it or having anything to do with it, and I was sort of enjoying it. I was thinking, oh, that's really funny, that voice, that crow's voice. So it's sort of like they kind of take me by surprise as if I have no relationship with them, and I do have a.
I think we should do Histor and Pliny for real, well, as a real, a genuine kid show.
Well, the problem is, right, I don't want to, but. You can't. Puppets, right, we designed those puppets, and then a cartoonist drew them, and then a model person made them. And then they went, the BBC had them, obviously. Then after the series finished, a number of things happened. One was my electric guitar, which I'd had for about 20 years, which I'd used in a sketch in it, was mysteriously lost, and no one offered to compensate me for that. And the other thing that happened, a Fender copy, it was really good. And the other thing that happened was that the puppets of Histor and Pliny stayed at the BBC and started being used as sort of background artists in Saturday morning kids show television stuff, which really irritated us. We managed to get them back. But tragically, when I just moved recently, I put the Pliny in the cellar. But I didn't know the cellar wasn't damp-proofed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he's got all, like, a kind of crust on him now.
Well, Histor, I've got Histor.
He's rotted, basically.
Yeah, I've got Histor, but all of his limbs have fallen off. And so we should do it with the rotten.
It's exactly the kind of thing that the Leicester Square Theatre's Museum of Comedy would be displaying in its own cabinet.
We could remake the puppets. I mean, they were expensive. They were like £3,000 each, I seem to remember, in the 1990s. But they were really expensive to make. Mine was slightly... Histor had a slight animatronic eye.
Yeah, but you were never good enough to use it. You just sort of rocked him around.
I did that on purpose.
Moved his mouth in a... thing was irrelevant to what you were
saying. Very much like Tommy Cooper playing the piano badly.
Well, you had to be really good at it to do it wrong. Those do have a brutal quality about them. I think it's really funny. It's sort of like, and I'm sort of, you know, things take you by surprise because you can't actually remember it. I mean, I remember just being that we used to have to do those at the end of the morning. And it really hurt your arm, and I was really tired.
I think we did like five in a row. I mean, I think we recorded them all in a day, and I just remember
you had to wear a balaclava. I mean, I know, like, people who work in mines, that's really hard and stuff. But I had to crouch behind a wall wearing a balaclava, holding my arm up, doing a high voice for about 5 hours once. And, you know, really
do you remember where they came from? Do you remember where the idea of Histor's Eye came from, though? It was in a... we wrote a radio pilot which was going to have Steve Coogan and Patrick Marvin. We recorded it, I think, called Corridor, which was... I was going to do it as whatever became of where we did a parody of the Profumo affair. So it was looking back at in history.
Which needed to be... You'll notice the Profumo affair has not raised its head since...
Since that was never broadcast. And so then, I don't know why, I mean, we obviously came up with Histor's Eye, because we thought, Histor's Eye. But I don't know why, I mean, Pliny obviously is a historian. But it's kind of an odd leap to make, to name them that.
Well, to you, maybe. Yeah. The way I work.
But Pliny was, Pliny's an amazing character.
Well, it's very kind of you to say, but I don't remember giving any thought to it. I just remember thinking that it was... It worked well that...
Do you think we should do that when we do the commentaries for these episodes, should we do one whole episode as Histor?
Well, I don't know if I could... I don't know if I could even get that... Do that voice anymore. It's too high.
I think to do it for 45 minutes of just finding egg... Because they're just, you know...
No, I do find those really funny when I see them. Right? It's funny. It's strange, like, being forced to confront these things with a... distance, because you can't remember having done them, so it's like another person did them. And of course you'll tell me realistically another person did do them, because there's no, you know, your whole body's been replaced since then on a cellular level.
I will tell you that, and it is true.
It's the kind of thing you say.
It is.
But so you look at them and you can sort of enjoy them, but it seems arrogant because you go, nah, that's really funny. Oh, I did that. But I do like those. I think they have a cumulative effect as well of the sort of irritation level of them. You know, good.
Good. And we'll talk about this, but there's one episode where we are both at the beginning. We start each episode with quite a weak thing where we dress us up from something from the week and then do it, just go, I'm Jeremy Clarkson, welcome to this. But there was one where we started both dressed as Jimmy Savile. Do you remember this one?
Yeah, well, again, I had no memory of it until this Jimmy Savile thing came out, and then it was on the internet. I don't remember doing it.
It's the London Marathon that week.
We're in the London Marathon. We're both just Jimmy Savile. We're sort of running towards the camera, and you say...
It's basically, we go, now then, now then, now then, now then. And then we go, it's London Marathon. I hope no one dies. And then I think you say, if they do, Bagsy, I take them to the morgue. Or the other way. Now,
but why that was is... This is an interesting thing. Now, because Jerry Sadovitz, who's a much better comedian than either of us, did a routine about Savile in the 80s, and he's now being hailed by journalists. Oh, he lifted the lid. But actually, we didn't know anything about it. There was this insane rumour that everyone heard about. It was like a joke that Jimmy Savile was a necrophiliac. And of course it was ludicrous, because no one was a necrophiliac. So you couldn't possibly believe it was real. And of course it wouldn't have done that joke if we thought it was real. So it was just like a response to this mad, stupid sort of showbiz rumour. It's as ludicrous as the Mark Almond one, which the more you think about, not possible, is it? I mean, how would you... They don't have the technology to analyse dogs' birth. So it's not... And it seemed like in the same world as that, which is why we did that joke. We didn't think it was real. And then suddenly, oh, like prophets or something. I didn't really know.
Well, I found surprised. I remember we tried to do a few Jimmy Savile jokes in different shows, and we were told we couldn't do it, because the reason he got away with it all, really, ironically, as it's turned out, is because he was very litigious, so if you said anything, he would sue. So the BBC, our producer, would say, oh, don't make a joke about Jimmy Savile, because if you do anything slightly euphemistic around anything around that, he'll sue. And that's how he kept that power. Ironically, now the BBC having to pay out rather more money than they would have had to do for our stupid joke. But I can't understand why that one...
Well, again, maybe it's to do with the way the thing was... You know, maybe it was just at the last minute, you know, and no one had time to check it. I mean, there were things like
that.
We had
costumes on. Someone had got some admittedly not very good costume. So we'll quickly... do you remember, just in the milk drinking thing, there was a bit with the unusual music in that I think you must have chosen. Was that different? It goes food and milk, and then there's a bit when we reveal the milk. It goes... Did you choose that music? That was fucking insane. There's Men of Achievement 1974, which I was very upset.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Not now it's popular, but there it was... I was very upset that that never kicked off. I thought that was going to be the real thing that propelled us to the big time, which was genuinely a book. I think people didn't understand what it was.
Yeah.
But you'd found it at a...
No, you jumble found
center. It. We found it at some junk shop. We had a few copies.
Again, this is another weird thing about this. Is that it's sort of... We would find an odd thing, like a weird leaflet or a strange book, and think, oh, let's do something with this. And in Fist of Fun, very much... the first series particularly had a sensibility of sort of bricolage, of all these sort of found objects cobbled together. And I suspect that sensibility has sort of disappeared because of the internet, because you can find things, because there's websites called Stuff I Found on the Floor and things like that. So everyone can kind of do that. Whereas I think part of what informed our sense of humour was like random things that we found on the floor, and then we, or just in a junk shop, and then we'd sort of think, well, what if you chose to focus in massively on this? But of course, that, I think that sort of sensibility has disappeared because because people today expect to be able to find anything they're looking for. I mean, another example of that was the lettuce. We had this thing with a sort of family of vegetables, and we just sort of move them around and make stupid noises, and it was sort of received with naked hostility, really. But then in the 11, was it called the 11 o'clock show? Yeah. Afterwards.
Yeah.
They had a thing which was the same about 2 years later, but it was like vibrators and dildos and things. It was just like a rip-off of it, but it was like with sex toys, so like morons would laugh at it, you know. And so there were weird kind of things, that were sort of pointless things, but then other people had the genius to make them obscene, therefore funnier.
One of the sons, I think, of one of the men of Achievement 1974 we featured once emailed me to ask me why we did it.
Yeah.
And he said, was it? And I said, it was out of a sense of just, this is a ridiculous vanity project, and it was kind of funny.
Well, that's very sensitive to say that.
He had a funny... And he said, was it partly because we chose funny pictures, because they were all the guys with stupid facial hair.
Well, it was
hair.
A book where people basically paid to be in a book in 1974 to say that they were important.
And there was a, you know,
much like Rich appearing in major venues at Edinburgh now.
Well, we're talking about Rod Hull, who we were going to try and do Rod Hull sketches in the second series of This Morning, Richard Not Judy, but unfortunately, as we sat on the set rehearsing the first episode after having recorded six episodes of a sketch where the character of Rod Hull, a man who thinks he's Rod Hull or pretends to be Rod Hull in return for getting jelly, does a task, but because he refuses to admit that he has a false arm during the task, he then dies at the end of each sketch. We then got the news as we sat on set that the real Rod Hull had fallen off of the roof.
And I would hope that the Rich could remember, he may remember better than me, I would hope that we took a moment to feel awful about Rod Hull before we realised we had a massive gap in next week's
The first thing I thought was, oh fuck, we can't do the sketches.
No, right.
And then I thought, and it is sad that the man is dead.
Well,
but
yeah,
we did meet him, so it was sad that he died. But that was you can see one of them is online. Gareth Karavec, his son, Gareth Karavec, who was our director, who has also sadly died. His son edited one of them together. So if you go on YouTube, or I suspect on this DVD somewhere, you will be able to find one of them put together in most of its glory. But we recorded about four or five.
Yeah, there was a rugby one as well, wasn't there? Didn't make it.
Yeah, there was rugby. There's a fencing one.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've got the scripts anywhere. I mean, you know, enough time has passed. I remember John Plowman.
I doubt he'll be able to get his own vehicle now.
John Plowman asked to watch them to check whether it was all right. I remember him going, and I just watched the sketches. And then he came back and went, yeah, we can't do that. But we did have a little tribute to Rod Hull at the end of that series.
Did we?
Well, yeah, I think at the end it ended with the false Rod Hull sitting by the phone going, ring, please ring, why is no one ringing me anymore?
Again, that whole Rod Hull thing was another thing that came out of, on the radio, we used to write the scripts in the day and then throw these voices at the last minute at people, and we said to Kevin Eldon, can you do Rod Hull? And he went, no, and he did this sort of kind of voice. We went, oh, that'll do.
I think he had a cold as well, so
yeah,
he
had a cold. And then that sort of suggested this other character that was someone doing it who wasn't Rod Hull, pretending to be. And so lots of things are as a result of accidents. And the fact that the show went out live and was put together in a hurry, I think, gave you, it forced you to try to run with things that perhaps, if you'd had more time, you would have abandoned, but which, because of that, became quite good things in their own right.
Yeah, I think we ended up doing more Simon Quinlank as a result of that. Not sure they were quite as good as the ones from the...
No.
There was that weird one with... Was the last one, was that in Fist of Fun, or was that in This Morning, where the last one was where he basically went mad and saw loads of images of himself?
Yeah. I can't remember. Well, I remember doing a load of drawings.
And yeah. That was good fun, wasn't it? That was nice. maybe we could get the other guys back on. We like you around, Trevor and Paul Putner. Come back in, find a seat, and come in. Give it a round of applause.
When
Trevor.
You say find a seat,
they can sit down. We'll find some seats.
Oh, that's great.
We only got one seat. Okay.
Sit over here. You sit in that one. You sit in that one. I'll go on the end. You sit there. I'll go on there.
So, ask them some questions, Stu. Ask these what they
what
remember
is your
about them.
Favourite character that you have played? Which Herring has made you do?
I think Peter Gibbs.
Yeah, we didn't talk about Peter Gibbs.
You know what's really awful about Peter Gibbs was When Things Fall Over, which is like a parody of these kind of cheap cable channel shows of clips of low-level disasters. And we wrote it together, but the impetus was basically my memories of my childhood of being in a sort of divorced family with various people, like having to do access days and, you know, the sort of meat of it. Leading up to the stuff falling on the people was all just actual memories from my childhood, and I mean the bit when you're in your pants. There was a bit where Peter Gibbs is the father of the little boy, and he's just in his pants, and he's watching television, and he's eating yogurt, and all the yogurt goes all over
beetroot.
Him.
Beetroot. Get it wrong. Beetroot.
Beetroot. Yeah. Well, it's based on Saturdays with my dad, and. Eat like different snacks that he got out of little pots, and they would inevitably get. He only used to wear underpants at the weekend. He didn't wear any clothes, and he's a hilarious bloke. The tragedy about those things, all the people that I wrote about who seemed comical to me at the time, they're all dead now. Well, they are, and it's a weird. Like, I don't think I'll be able to watch them again because it seemed. You'd sort of fed this stuff into this rather light-hearted thing, and then as you get older and you become a parent, you sort of think about what would have been going through those people's minds as adults, dealing with children, dealing with their relationships. And when we wrote this programme, I was 27, 28, and you were still young enough to not really have any real connection with the world, and or with responsibilities or emotional ties. And,
I think they're very, you know, there's a kindness to them. There's a feeling of that within. I mean, it's great within a sketch show that's got stupid stuff like talking organs and lettuce leaves to have something that was suddenly quite dark. And but that happens a lot in the show. There's a lot of very
but
dark.
The journey,
bits.
The arc of Peter Gibbs.
Yeah.
It starts off where he just talks about his son getting stung by a bee. And it's just him sort of talking about, you know, being a weekend dad and stuff like that.
Well, you did it incredibly well. I mean, you were given a very lightweight thing and you gave a terrible death to it.
Well, you had me rolling around in my pants well, outside with Emma Kennedy opening the curtains going... Fucking hell! Which is mimed, but you can clearly see it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a number of things from that. I remember going in the White Line of Mortimer on Stroud Green Road in the afternoon once, and there being this couple that had obviously got a divorce but were trying to thrash something out, and they were having some pub lunch, you know, and the man was... The woman had held it together, and the man was getting more and more depressed and desperate, and that went into a whole one of those. And the thing of, I remember stumbling across the pornography collection of one of my mum's boyfriends, and that went into one of those where all the pornography fell out on him.
It's so well-meaning, and the one in the pub where it's really nice because they're in the pub and you're trying to reconcile. She's just meeting up with you and she's having spaghetti and you're really cross that she's having... It's 1990s food, but it's a really horrible-looking plate of spaghetti with red sauce on it. Yeah. She's just sophisticated.
That was just this thing that I saw. And weirdly, I don't know if I would do that now because I would feel bad about looking at someone's life and thinking, oh, God, that's awful. How can we make a funny sketch? I don't think I could do that now. And I would go through all sorts of layers of distancing and of changing details. And the tragedy is it wouldn't be as funny because there's something about a real detail that is normally absolutely perfect. And you couldn't imagine the thing because there's something about the banality of everyday life and the mundanity of things that is just... absolutely perfect. And I think pretty soon after we worked on those, I would never have done anything like that again because I would have felt really bad about being like a vampire sort of feeding off people's unhappiness and misery and the sort of...
For a laugh.
Yeah, no, yeah. I couldn't do it now. And actually, you know, I think there's a window that you miss where you have a freedom to do those kind of things. And I think as you become sort of drawn into society as a result of marriage or children or, you know, relationships with other kids' parents or whatever, you don't have that freedom to find it all utterly banal and abhorrent because you're a part of it.
Do you think that when John Cleese said, you know, sketch comedy is a young man's game,
yeah,
is that what he was kind of hinting at? That you're able to go, look at this loser. Look, he's a failed showbiz entertainer. Yeah. Look at these failed adults, and you're playing people, you know, a lot older than yourself. And you suddenly go,
you're that person. Yeah. And it's not a bad thing to be involved in society and have responsibilities to children, as you'll find you may enjoy it. You may get some blogs out of it. But you'll find that you do suddenly things that you previously had a distance from and found ridiculous, you're a part of them, so it's harder to get a distance on them. And that whole the family relationships in When Things Fall Over, that was sort of one of the, you know, there was a, if it had been 5 years later, I couldn't have written those because they would be too close to home, and also they would have felt like a betrayal of trust. But I probably, I'm not really looking forward to seeing them again. I think when I tell my son that my dad spent the whole weekend just in his pants watching sport and giving me like
beetroot
sort of jam out of pots on bread, he finds it hilarious, which gives me the suggestion that on some level I'm better than that. But I think it's also a look back to, you know, the 70s, 80s when there's a sort of pressure. Parents now are supposed to be, you're supposed to do stuff and engage. You know, really, I remember being, I might even have patterned in that in one of those episodes. I remember just being sort of left in a car outside a pub with Chris. Do you remember that? Did that happen to you? Were you just like left?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't remember it from the show.
No, but do you remember being just shut in a car outside a pub?
I was once, when I was a baby, I was left in a car for a bit too long. My parents came back and I'd nearly died.
Yeah.
I was really red. Yeah. And they'd left me a bit too long with the window open a little bit. And I think it probably accounts for a lot. But, you know, you sort of think if that had happened, you know, if they'd left another half an hour, that's a different story.
That whole thing about families, then it was about that sort of rather more robust attitude people had to kids and family in that period. And, like, you know, I mean, I don't remember being sort of, You get the pub, you pull up outside the car, you put in the car outside the pub, your dad goes in, gets you a can of Coke and a packet of crisps, and he locks you in the car. Like, there are people who have gone to prison for that now. In the 60s, in the 70s, that was, you know, at least you had crisps, you know, like, that was considered a sort of, you know, a thoughtful parent. And then they would drive you home drunk. And that whole thing was that was the only, that's one of the only things, weirdly, in my whole life of doing comedy that I've ever put any of myself into. And I did that because I was confident it would be forgotten. Richard Herring and Chris Evans of Go Faster Strike have excavated it, yeah, and now made me confront this terrible history.
That'll be good for you, I think.
At least I can look at you as my son.
And well, did you cover Emma Kennedy in baked beans out of some sexual desire to see Emma Kennedy covered in baked beans?
I can't remember what that was about. I can't remember what that was about. I remember, I don't know.
Did that happen to your mum?
No. No, I don't know what that was about.
No, that wasn't.
I can't actually remember that one.
No,
it was I remember, weirdly, again, this dates it, that when we filmed the one where all the pornography fell out of the cupboard on the child's head, the editors of Men Only got in touch with us and said, thanks for plugging our magazine. And they sent loads of pornography.
Hey,
yeah, yeah.
And the
bloke that was the editor went on to be quite a good comedy writer, actually. And one of them was, anyway, write sketches for people. But it was kind of weird, like it was sort of, again, looking back to the 90s, I thought, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But it was funny, wasn't it? Like that kind of, people would get in touch. Remember when we went to get those shirts?
Yeah, we went to, well, you were ridiculous because you were so concerned about, we went to Ted Baker, to the actual...
They wanted to give us some shirts,
so
Ted Baker.
We went to Ted Baker, which made really expensive shirts.
In the 90s when they were trendy.
And with a view to wearing their shirts on TV. And it was quite... The costume lady had sorted this all out for us and we might get some free shirts. And then she said, I'm embarrassed to wear shirts like this, and if I do, I always cut the name of the shirt off of the shirt. In the meeting. So the blokes went, all right, well, and then we didn't get any free shirts. So, so we had to pay. We had to pay for them. We still wore their shirts, but we had to pay for them. They were nice shirts.
They were.
You gave me all of yours. I
can't fit into any of those shirts. I expect you can now get back into all your shirts.
It's a nice thing about losing a bit of weight. Yeah. And the Curious Orange came about because it was from the fall, but was it?
Yeah,
also?
It's an experimental 60s Swedish film. And so the phrase was in my head, Curious Orange. So I thought, well, you know, that's all it takes, isn't it? Well,
yeah.
On some level, there's a subliminal relationship in people's minds, like an orange that was curious. It wasn't, didn't really, and there was a little bit of music from the fall that would serve as an intro.
Yeah.
I expect that, you know, that's all it takes, isn't it?
Just two words. Sort of notes and queries type of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Did Mark E. Smith ever comment on that? I know he's.
I heard from his manager that he tried to get some money out of the BBC for the music being played, but there was a blanket agreement with the BBC that you don't get any money from anything.
I remember you saying at the time. I think you did broach it with him after a gig or something, and he just went, oh, it's mad that, isn't it?
Well, there's a funny thing where he's, I don't know if he hates me, but he often puts my name into songs in a really uncomplimentary way. I suspect means he probably does hate me. If I ever end up like Stuart Lee, cut off my head with a garden tool, and there's a thing on the new live album, I can't really hear it, I can just hear my name in the middle of a load of slurring. I wonder what that is.
But, he's trying to make you curious, isn't he?
Well, you know, yeah. But, I mean, you know, that's one of those. He's always been an inspiration, and I suppose one of the mistakes I've made in having him as an inspiration is you sometimes reference a thing, and you suspect that everyone's going to go, "Ha ha, that's a reference to the fall, hilarious," but in fact, they don't know the source, so they think it's your sort of thing. And I probably wouldn't do it again, because you can't do a homage to something if the thing's less well known than you are. And what a lot of these young XFM DJs that do stand up who rip me off have to realise is they might be doing a bit of my routine change to make fun of me, but the reviewer doesn't know the source material, so thinks that they're some kind of genius when in fact they're a twat. but actually there was loads of stuff fed in from obscure popular culture into those. I mean, you're you know, a maven for that kind of thing, and you've sort of informed us of loads of stuff. And again, I mean, I think half the fun of it was thinking, I wonder if people will spot this. And it's a very 20, 30-something sort of thing to do, to sort of drop all these references in, like with the particular kinds of shots you would choose and film stuff or whatever. And we had a lot of fun doing that. Like, part of finding your own voice, actually, is assimilating influences from other things.
I remember you agonising if you felt in any way whatsoever you might be plagiarising at all. And it's when you had the Curious song, Curious Orange singing, I had a little donkey.
Yeah.
I think you later put in the...
Well, I've done it. I mean, that's a song
it was on Rutland Weekend.
I remember
my...
Well,
you got really worried about
no,
it.
No, my granddad sang it to me as a kid, and it was obviously a musical song from the Midlands. But weirdly, the only... I had a little donkey. I had a little donkey. I kept him in the yard. One day in the winter time when it was snowing hard, Mother said the donkey would be cold out in the stall. Bring him in the kitchen. That one. Anyway, so...
I think he was hoping you'd join in there, but that was
the only extant version of it was from Rutland Weekend Television, which was Eric Idle's post-Python thing, where he did it with those blokes from Pato, didn't he?
Yeah, something...
Prog rock band.
I remember sort of mentioning it to you, just went, oh, fucking hell.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously
I mean,
they knew
it. Matter.
Obviously they knew it from earlier, but I didn't know about that then. Only you would know about that. And that's how you found out how to sing it. Oh, no, no, you're... I mean, you're an incredible...
Git.
You know... No, I mean, you know about everything. I don't know how you... You know about... You know all things. You know all different kinds of music and all films. You've know more music and films than you've had time in your life to watch or listen to. What are you? Like an immortal character from beyond...
I am the Oracle of Delphi.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, but it all kind of hits a ceiling around 2002. Yeah.
And we tried to get Jason Orange in to be the Curious Orange... On one occasion.
That's right.
Was that one of the times you weren't there? Because it might be.
I can't remember. I mean, we tried to get Robbie Williams.
Yeah, we
tried
to get
Greg Evigan. And
we never got cool enough. Like a lot of those other shows were cool that they would have got Robbie Williams.
Yeah, but you know what? Wasn't that a blessing? I mean, again, it was sort of being under the radar. And, you know, there was a point where Newman and Badil were on the front of the NME. And you, like, rightly identified me as 20-something. As having been the sort of person that would have liked that. But actually, it was a narrow escape from... it was a narrow escape for both of us from being identified with a particular period or with a particular period of fashion, and that you're able to just carry on. And the people that are kind enough to come and see you 20 years later, they're not... held into a particular period, like you know. So I think it was really, actually that stuff was really lucky. Like at the time, I remember you'd sort of think, how come these people can tour at these levels and not lose money and be on all these things? But actually, the long game of being able to then do stuff like this 20 years later and being, I mean, can David Baddiel do a podcast where he plays snooker against himself?
I don't think he can.
No, he can't do that. And I'm not trying to be facetious thing. It's actually an amazing thing that you can, you know, you've said this yourself a lot, that you can have the fluidity to be able to do that. And partly is because somehow we got through that period when comedy was the new rock and roll without anyone really
noticing. Well, also what's kind of interesting, I think, out of that, sort of the new Deal and Skinner is that kind of new lab thing. That it's all like now, 20 years on, that starts
toxic.
It starts to look like, you know, you'll be like the 1970s guys telling racist jokes.
Yeah, yeah,
if you're the 1990s guys going, yeah, anal sex tits, you know, which we didn't escape entirely from doing jokes like that.
No, but because we now control the rights to our own old DVDs, we're able to edit those bits out.
If anything, though, it's kind of it's interesting the other way, because you're so puritanical in you know, that was the joke about it. You're having to go at Gail Porter all the way through in the series in a way that sort of feels a little bit cruel now in retrospect, but is from the point of view of a sort of feminist perspective, I suppose.
Yeah. Shrink wrapped chicken.
Well, you know, we'll see if that makes the.
The thing is, it sort of has to, because it's all the way through every...
do you remember your Mel C? I want your gamete.
Yeah.
What?
I did the five types of women.
Ugly Spice and all that.
Yeah. So there's elements of it, but to actually be associated with, and that routine is still about, it's still about taking the piss out.
We escaped mid-90s lad culture via not being invited to join in with it.
Talking of which, is Trevor still not allowed to speak?
While Stu is on stage, it was mainly Stu who stopped that.
Why was that?
I can't remember why that happened.
He was jealous.
I think it was just for the... I don't think it was a genuine... It wasn't genuinely that we couldn't afford to pay you anymore, but it was just the funny idea that that would be the case.
How did you feel about that?
It was really heartbreaking for me. It was awful. Because I looked up to you two... Weirdly, you two were like my two dads in comedy. And I looked up to
what,
you.
What, we were like your two dads, or we were like my two dads from the sitcom? Not Greg like Evigan and Paul Reiser.
No, you weren't like them, okay. But you were like
your two dads.
Yeah, Paul was like a mum to me. Because I knew Paul loved me, and I didn't have to prove anything to him, but you two, I felt, you know, I had to prove myself.
Yeah.
And, I still do.
Yeah, you've still got a lot to prove, son.
Thanks.
So, I think we were going for that sort of Samuel Beckett thing, certainly in Fist of Fun, where it was like we were all kicking the person down. We were all fairly sad.
Yeah.
You were kicking me and I was kicking Pete. And
yeah.
In this, you know, yeah. There's quite a lot of nasty bullying that I don't really like looking back at, because I think it doesn't... There's plenty of bits that you look at, 50, and there would have to be, that 15 years later you look back and go, well, I wish I hadn't pulled that slightly disabled person face during that routine, or whatever. So, you know, I think... But then that's all about living and learning and changing, you know. So it's...
Yeah.
It's
but, you know, it can be... It can be edited out. It will be.
It can be edited out. We're going to be left with hardly anything. A few of the episodes.
So do you think it would have suffered from e-petitions?
Well, you know, that's another weird thing. Is that, in a way, we tried to do stuff that created a relationship with the audience and encouraged them to write in and get involved in things and sort of create the comedy themselves, and then we'd sort of roll with it. Now... 20 years later, I mean, it would almost be unmanageable, because the amount of feedback you'd get from the internet and Twitter would be out of control. You couldn't really do it. In fact, things would get... If you said to people now, why don't you try and write the biggest swear word you can and hang it off a building, it would, so many people would do that. It would be appalling. So it's sort of... I think it was in a weird window between this sort of... post-punk thing of, like, let's involve the people. And yet, actually, pretty soon, the technology existed to involve the people so thoroughly that it would have been unworkable, because they'd have been far too involved. I think what probably would have happened that we missed out on is that, despite the fact that there wasn't a critical approval for it or an approval from the broadcaster, there would have, if there'd been a Twitter and the internet, there would have been a visible groundswell of support from viewers that might have changed a commissioner's mind about things. And certainly, you know, I know I've benefited from that subsequently. But I don't know if that would have been the right thing, because actually I think it had done what it set out to, and it lives in the memory in quite an exciting way for people, partly because it was truncated. And to look back at it now, when the DVD comes out, I think people will go, how was that ever allowed to happen? And the answer is, it wasn't really, it was an accident. but, you know, anything you talk about from popular culture now, if it's before 2000, you have to factor in the fact that Twitter and the internet didn't really exist in the way it does now, and that just changes everything. I mean, we sort of tried to get that kind of thing going with all the write-in things on the radio.
Yeah, and we did respond to everyone who wrote to us.
Yeah.
Manually writing everyone letters back. Only if people wrote four letters a week did we not write to them.
I mean, I still meet people to this day who are like 35, 40 now, who've come to see you for 20 years because you replied to a letter they sent. And of course, you could do that then, because it was quite hard to send in a letter. Whereas now, you know... Anyone can send off an email, which has devalued the whole notion of interaction between. I wrote a fan letter to The Fall in 1982, and Steve Hanley, the bass player, replied to it with a postcard from Berlin. And earlier this year, which is 32 years later, I wrote a little bit about his book and chaired a discussion when he did a launch for it. And it's partly because of that incredible thing to a 14-year-old that it makes a big impression, but I don't know if it has the same currency anymore.
Well, I don't see what people sometimes seem impressed if you reply. I mean, some people seem impressed if you reply to a tweet, you know, and it's a different sort of thing, but it's a lot easier to do. But I suppose it breaks down that division as well. So maybe in the 90s, people who were on TV were very far aloof, and now it's only people.
I never felt like we were on TV. I felt like we were sort of allowed in for a bit.
But I don't think we were typical of, you know, I don't think we were typical in that we were kind of accessible. We were sort of internet accessible.
Well, you always had a sense of the absurdity of it, which was very refreshing. I mean, we all hear horror stories in this business. You all hear horror stories of someone who's been going 2 years and gets a telly show and suddenly they expect to have their ciabatta delivered to them by an oiled slave. whereas we always found you were very good at finding the whole thing ridiculous, and all those routines that were in Vista Fun about I stood next to Jeremy Paxman, I touched his sleeve and stuff like that were, tragically, they were based on actual responses to the situation of being within the orbit of fame. And I still feel like I don't belong. I know that's an increasingly untenable, ludicrous position to feel like, but you sort of feel like it's something that's happening to other people and you get to spectate on it, and also you're acutely aware of the bizarre behaviour of other people, and I think you were always really alert to that, which was a great thing in that we managed to maintain the feeling that the programme shouldn't have been on and we shouldn't have been allowed to do it.
Yeah.
Of course, well, actually, the irony was that was the case.
Yeah. But that's why it's good we didn't get Jason Orange and Robbie Williams to be in it, you know, because it would have given it a sense of you know, being part of everything, and it really was. We really weren't part of anything.
what was it? Richard Madeley and Judy Finnegan actually said the finest.
They said, because Frank Skinner had been on Richard Madeley and Judy Finnegan's programme, there was obviously some PR deal done with our management where we had to be on the next week, and they greeted us with a heavy heart and sat through one of our bits. And then afterwards, she said, yeah, it's comedy about nothing, really, isn't it? Which, actually, I think was what we'd been aiming for.
But also on that, Richard Madeley, they'd gone before, we want four, because it's school half-term, we went to come up with four things that, you know, kids can be doing, four activities that kids can be doing, a joke about that. And so instead of doing that, Richard Madeley went, you guys, you're so funny, you could make a joke about anything. Tell us a joke about it. And then he named one of the things he knew we had. So it, and then it wasn't really a joke we had prepared anyway, yeah, but it was such an odd way to get into it, to make this sort of false leap.
Do you know what? This might be your out point. Okay. But years later, I was on a chat show with Richard Madeley years, I don't know why or what it was, about 5 years, 10 years later. He said, oh yeah, I remember you, blah, blah, blah. And then, apropos of nothing, he started telling me this anecdote about how he and Judy had been on a holiday in a cottage in the countryside somewhere, and he'd looked out of the window and he'd seen a man in the field having sex with a donkey. And he called her over to look at it. And,
yeah.
Well, I'm just saying that's what I mean. You know, he didn't. I think he was trying to get in with me.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was the sort of thing I'd...
Well, I did their show a couple of times when they went to Channel 4. And then
did they mention that to you?
He didn't talk about that, but he did...
no secret affair anecdote.
But they were. He was noticeably, like, you know, trying to be get in with you and be sweary. I don't know if they remembered who I was or knew I was. But I mean, it wasn't really anything to do with them. It was sort of, I suppose, a little bit cruel.
The one thing we had that was weird was one of the first dates of our tour, after the first series of This One with Richard and Judy, was Whole Truck Theatre, and some people that were really visibly unhappy in the front row left at half time, and we found out later they'd been expecting to see Judy Finnegan and Richard Madeley. And we often speculated at which point during the first hour did they decide they probably weren't going to show up. But politely waited until after. The other thing, and this is, again is ruins that would have been a good out point, but is there was some graffiti in the toilets there, I remember, about the quality of the excrement of the bass player from Amazing Blondel, who were an early 70s Lincolnshire progressive rock band, which I was considerably more interested in than you. Because Eddie Baird's shit really stinks. And Amazing Blondel had just got back together, yeah. And one of their warm-up gigs had been at... and I was going, wow, Eddie Baird from Amazing Blondel, shit really stinks.
Is that, was Francis Monkman?
No, he was in Caravan. No, he was in... He was in Caravan, Francis Monkman.
Was he?
Yeah.
I thought he was
No, he's from...
See, I'm not that clever.
Canterbury. No, he was in... Curved Air.
Curved Air.
Yeah, yeah. So,
it's definitely not turned into an end point now. is... Maybe the last word should go to Trevor.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure to listen to you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me on stage to listen on stage.
Well,
I mean, it was great listening backstage, but being on stage and listening, it's just they're different when you can see the words coming out of... the sweat and you it puts it in the context, the sweaty faces, so thanks for that.
You know what, you'll have a sweaty face when you're older.
But it'll sweaty be small little though, face won't it, yeah. Stuart, it'll be a small sweaty face.
He's 41 years old, can you believe
he's
it?
He's not.
He is.
I'm not. But would you like to apologise to people with small faces now after,
I mean, you know, there's so many things I'd like to apologise for from the 90s, and it's great that you've led the charge for the small face, and it's just one of the many things that I'm sure will come to rain down upon us of criticisms when the whole thing actually goes out. Also, I think that it's you're this odd footnote in this, but of course your own stand-up is actually superb and is of far greater value than anything that we'll be releasing that gives any indication of what you do. So, a tragedy. Most people that know you will see you something doing, see you doing something that's of far less value than your own work, which is a grim tragedy.
It was good when you dressed up as a bit of Crest, though.
Yeah.
That was very good. Ladies and gentlemen, Stuart Lee, Paul Butler, Trevor Love. Thank you for coming. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Stuart Lee. Who's that? The music you're listening to is by Pest. Thank you to Orange Mark at the British Comedy Guide, who probably has nothing to do with this one, to be honest. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, from Go Faster Stripe, who has lots to do with it. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for having us during this run. It's been fantastic. My producer is Dave Cribb. It is a fuzz. GoFasterStripe.com and Sky Potato Production. We'll be back in May next year. Bye!
Woohoo! That's it. It's the end of the series. Thank you so much for your support during the series. It's been terrific fun, apart from that last one with Stuart Lee, which was not as much fun. So do come and see me on tour, richardherring.com for all the details. Go and buy a DVD from GoFasterStripe.com or a badge from GoFasterStripe.com/badges, or just tell your friends about this phenomenal podcast. We'll be back in June and July with some more. And then hopefully, if we can carry on just making a living at it somehow, we can carry on doing these into the future. Any contribution you can make is massively appreciated, but we'll carry on without you. That's just the way we are. We don't need money. Please, my baby needs food and shoes. Thanks for listening. See you in a few months. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.